Blog Talk Radio.
Consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Danny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, former police chief, private investigator and instructor at Boston University, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. Crime Wire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the Crime Wire team information about an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Susan and Denny have the night off. Now to our first case. On August 13, 1992, Pima County, Arizona Sheriff's deputies responded to the home of Morton Custer, located in an affluent Tucson, Arizona neighborhood. Upon arrival, deputies discovered the bodies of the 57-year-old homeowner, Mort Custer, and his 60-year-old brother, Howard Custer. There was no sign of forced entry to the home, and both men had been shot at close range. Law enforcement has been unable to solve this nearly 20-year-old baffling unsolved double murder. The daughter of one of the victims, Denise Savastano, a California private investigator, is cautiously optimistic that this cold case can be cracked. P.I. Savastano believes she knows the motive for the grisly crime and is focusing her attention on a particular person of interest. Joining us tonight to talk about the murder of her father, Mort Custer, and her uncle, Howard Custer, and to share the progress of her investigation is Denise Savastano. Denise, good evening, and thank you for joining us.
Good evening, Tom. Good evening, Vito. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're quite welcome. Listen, why don't we start off with, give us some family background. Tell us a little bit about your immediate family and your uncle.
Well, starting with my dad was obviously living in Tucson at the time of his murder. My uncle, all of that family comes from Chicago, Skokie to be exact, and they're all still living there. He had just recently retired as a school teacher for 30 years and had just gone to visit my dad for a couple of weeks prior, just after his retirement. I have a younger brother that's 3 years younger than I am that is going through this with me as well, and Howard has an extended family.
Okay. Now, you're a private investigator, and you've been in the business for quite some time.
Yes, 30 years.
30 years. And what's your investigative specialty at your firm? What's your focus?
Well, my focus and specialty has always been in corporate investigations. That's how I started, and that's where my strength is in investigations. It's only been since 2009, since I took over my dad's case that I started getting involved in the criminal end of investigations.
Okay, so tell us, how did you get involved? What was the first thing you did to acquaint yourself with the facts of the case file?
Well, what I had done was, over the years, of course, this happened in 1992, so over the course of the years, I had stayed in touch with the detectives to keep in touch with the case and if they were working on it and if there were, any progress at all in the case. And they, of course, there wasn't any. So in 2009, I was in a place where I could really focus on my dad's murder. And I called the detective that was in charge at the time and asked him if I could have copies of the files so that I could work on it myself. And he agreed. And he sent, about 2 weeks later, I got a box full of files, and I sat down and I started reading.
Okay, and again, some of the material that my partner, Vito Colucci, and I have been able to look at consists of a search warrant, autopsy report, and some articles. It's a very interesting case. Vito, would you like to jump in?
Denise, now, so you get a call, right? I mean, how did you find out that your dad and your uncle were killed? How did you find that out, first of all?
I had gotten a call from my brother, and he had asked me if we had a cousin by the name of Leslie, and I said yes, and it was one of Howard's daughters. And he said, well, she called me and told me that Dad and Howard had been murdered. And I was speechless, and I said, well, I don't know anything. Let me call Dad's house, and I'll call you back. And I called my dad's house, and Sheriff answered the phone. That's how I...
All right, and what brought the police to your dad's home? Was it, as I recall, there was a welfare check, a well-being check on the family?
Yes, that's correct. They were killed on the 13th. On the 14th, Howard was due back into Chicago, and his family was at the airport to pick him up. But, of course, he didn't show. So they called the Pima County Sheriff's and asked for a well check. And, when they went to the house, that's when they found them.
So, Denise, then, in other words, now you're already a private detective for about 10 years at that point, right?
Yes.
Okay, and even though you're mostly involved with the corporate stuff, you're still a private detective. And, like, what's your feeling at that point? I know if it's me or Tom and it's somebody, it's a relative, a cousin or whatever, we're going to say, man, I want to solve this case. I want to get on this case. Or I want to at least be able to, as a private detective, work along with the police regularly as far as updates and maybe get a little more did you get a little more better information, so to speak? Were they honoring you, at least for being a private detective at all? Or did they just do it like what they would do with the normal citizen?
At that time, it actually worked against me. They gave me less information because, of course, in the very beginning, everybody is a suspect, including myself.
Oh, sure.
So I got very little information from them in the very beginning.
Oh, okay. Okay.
In fact, to be perfectly honest with you, I really didn't get I didn't even understand the full scope of the case until I received the files in 2009.
Okay, so now this happens in 1992. How long did it take you, even though you're not involved in the case or anything of that nature, to know in your head you think you know who did this?
Well, in the very beginning, my stepmother was the prime suspect. My dad and stepmother was in the process of a divorce. They'd been married for 20 years. And my dad was worth a lot of money. He was well worth over $1 million. And, of course,
right,
the first person that myself and even the sheriff at that point looked at was the stepmother. But she was ruled out fairly early. They'd given her a polygraph test. She passed that. She was very cooperative. I mean, she even let them come in when her attorney wasn't around and ask her questions. She didn't have any problems with that at all. It wasn't until after I found out that they'd cleared her that they told me the other prime suspects became my dad's divorce attorney and her husband.
Let me just ask you this before Tom jumps in again. The night that your dad is with your uncle there, was your uncle supposed to be there that night? Was this a planned thing, or he just happened to come over there?
No, my uncle was supposed to be there that night. He was leaving the very next day for Chicago. So my feeling, or at least my opinion is, that he was killed for one of two reasons. The gentleman that killed him was afraid that my dad might have told him and he could implicate him in the murder, and or he was trying to throw the sheriffs off.
Right, right, right. Okay. Yeah, because I'm just trying to figure out why, you know, they pick a night that the two of them are together rather than one. So who do you feel they were after then, you're saying?
This was, in my opinion, it was my dad's divorce attorney and her husband.
Okay. Okay.
And Vito, what's interesting here is that there had been a loan to the husband of the divorce attorney, and the last night that the brothers were seen alive was at a restaurant where they had dinner with the attorney and her husband. Am I correct?
Mm.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And then that's absolutely correct. And then after the restaurant, they had gone back to my dad's house.
All right. Now, tell us a little bit about the and I realize, you know, this is painful. And you know, if you want, you know, just, you know, gloss over it. But the manner of the death, it's homicide. The cause is shooting, and can you tell our listeners about the dynamics of this, what can be called an execution murder? The placement of the shots, things like that, the caliber.
Yes, the placement of the shots and the caliber of the gun is very consistent with the way that the suspect was trained in Vietnam. He was in Vietnam. He was in a program called the Phoenix Program. And the execution style that was used on both my father and uncle was very similar to his training in the Vietnam War and also the caliber of weapon that was used.
And law enforcement was able to determine that he was an owner of really an arsenal of weapons, including 22 caliber pistols.
Yes, they were. They were absolutely. And a silencer, which they believe was used.
Okay. And how quickly does the focus on the attorney and her husband, how quick does that focus on them? And then, you know, why does it stall?
Well, the first answer is fairly quickly. I think that they were looking at both my stepmother and them because they were the last to see them. And also there was, after their initial interview, there were so many discrepancies in their two stories that, you know, that the antennas went up, and that's when they started to think, well, maybe we have a problem here too. The second answer is I don't know why it took so long, to be perfectly honest with you, but it did. It took too much time, in my opinion. It took them a year just to get a search warrant.
Denise, right. Let me ask you this. Do you still have any kind of relationship with your stepmother now or no?
My stepmother is deceased as of 2006, and prior to that, I had no relationship at all with her.
Oh, okay. Did you have one while your dad was still alive, or did this the murder kind of add to breaking that up?
No, her and I never got along, ever. I just liked her very much.
How long were they married, if I can ask you?
They were married almost 20 years.
Okay.
So
just trying to give a background for our listeners here so they understand all the dynamics of this.
Sure.
And Denise, now tell us a little bit about your father's efforts to leave a note or some correspondence in the event that he was killed.
Yes, absolutely. The attorney's husband had made a business deal with my father, and he actually admits to lying about why he wanted this money from my dad as far as this business deal goes. It was $18,300 that my dad had lent him for this business deal that he lied about. So my dad had insisted on a note between this, the attorney's husband and my dad. And my dad also made an audio recording for us kids, outlining, the loan amount, the reason for the loan, the person that the loan was with, what banks he took it out of. And he took that audio tape and a copy of the note, and he hid it in one of his boots in his tack room. And my stepmother was actually the one to find it, and she gave it to the sheriff's department.
Hmm. What do you make of that, Vito?
Yeah, I know. That's an interesting thing, because what was the amount again, Denise?
It was $18,300, but also, just to add to that, my dad even mentions right on the tape, if anything was to happen to me, if I were to have an accident, this money needs to be repaid to the estate.
Very interesting. That's kind of odd, Tom, because, I mean, you know, I'm not downplaying $18,000, but it's not a lot of money. You know what I mean? We're not talking $100,000, $200,000 where you get, you know, you work all kinds of agreements, and even a note of that nature for that big amount would be more noteworthy. You know what I mean? It doesn't make sense. And even if I die, the loan is still to be paid back. I don't know. It's unusual, you know.
But if you knew the suspect, okay,
yeah.
which he has been described by witnesses that I've spoken with as being very greedy. At the time of the murder, he and his wife were going through bankruptcy,
mm-hmm.
and she was starting her she had just passed the bar and was just starting her business. So $18,000 for him was a lot of money.
You think your dad was strong-armed a little bit on this?
It's very possible.
Okay.
I honestly don't know because my dad did leave the tape, you know, and saying that he did lend him the money. But to follow up to that, when this suspect was interviewed by the police and they showed the suspect the note that my dad had hid, he came up with his own copy of the note. That note supposedly is signed by my dad. And it says paid in full.
Oh.
However, the money was never found anywhere. It never
mm-hmm.
went back into the bank accounts. It was not found at the home. The money was gone.
Interesting.
I got to agree with you, Vito, that there seems to be a dimension of strong-arm tactics here. Because I bet that the first note came from the person of interest, and then followed up by Mort's own declaration that if anything happens to me, this is what you should investigate. That's
yeah,
just
I
my
mean,
situation.
You know, it's one thing if I'm lending you, you and me are friends, so to speak, and I'm lending you a huge amount of money to buy a beautiful place in Henderson, Nevada, and we try to get as many things from you as possible just to protect myself and just the whole deal. But I don't know. That just doesn't sit right with me.
So, Denise, where are you at with the investigation right now? And I know, you know, in our green room before the show, you cautioned us about, holding back information. But what can you publicly say at this point?
I can publicly say that the case is being actively investigated. I'm working with a detective. I'm still investigating the case, and I'm working alongside of him. And there are things that are being done as we speak, and that's the stuff that I'm really not at liberty to talk about at this time.
Sure. Yeah. Now, have you reached out to any experts like, ballisticians or forensic pathologists for assistance, or is that something that the Pima County Detectives Sheriff's Office is doing?
Well, and that's kind of where we're at. I'm at odds with the detective that I'm working with, is trying to direct the information out of them as to exactly what's been done and what needs to be done. I know that there are a lot of things that I have found, things that have not been done, that, you know, I spoke to him about. And so now it's just putting the pressure on and being, you know, and calling on a continuous basis and making sure that, you know, things are getting done. There's not been any specialists, no, not at this time. That would be nice. I would really like, you know, to be able to do that. But if you go outside of the labs that the Sheriff's Department uses, then it becomes private and then it comes out of your pocket.
Yep. Now, Denise, I can assume that this is your first investigation into a cold case murder?
Yes, it is.
All right.
It is.
Now, you know, Vito will certainly concur with me here. You know, your lament about, you know, you giving information and it's a one-way street, I can tell you that, you know, from my experience, that's precisely the root of the information. Vito?
Yeah, I mean, basically, Tom, you're 100% right with that. And when I get involved in these type of cases, I always make sure, wherever the jurisdiction is, that I handle everything the proper way. I meet with the people, the police officers, the chief, whatever, introduce myself as a ex-cop, let them know that I've done many, many murder cases, both as a cop and as a PI. But I also let them know that I'm only here to help you. And I use the terminology all the time, both when I'm speaking on a show, but mostly when I'm talking to other police officers, that I am here to assist you. Any information that I gathered will be given to you as soon as I gather it. I'm working, I like to say, I work parallel with the police department, okay? As soon as I gather information, it's given to them right away. Basically, I don't care who solves the case, especially now because the families are hiring me and they know my involvement and they know what I've turned over to the police. So whether I got credit on it or not is really immaterial. So that's kind of how I work that time with dealing with the police. I try to be a gentleman or a professional all the time. Now, in saying that, you still get the one or two times where they don't even want you around, you know, but you can't help it. I'm hired by the family. I'm paid money by the family, and I do my thing as long as I don't interfere with them or do anything that they would require me not to do. So.
Yeah. Now, Denise, any affiliation to law enforcement in your family?
My ex-husband Nick was a state trooper in the state of Massachusetts for about 8 years. So he's the one that I started the business with. He's 30 years ago. So you know, he was an ex-cop. So.
Okay. Well, you can certainly use that, you know, going forward. I suspect that once this case is resolved, and I'm very optimistic and confident that there'll be closure for this, and we look forward to having you come back and tell us about the effort. And let me ask you this: have you begun thinking of you know, memorializing your investigative efforts into a book?
I absolutely have. I would. It's something I'm actually doing on the side. But I have thought about that.
Well, you know, Vito has written a book. He's in writing another book. Maybe at some point the two of you connect, and he can give you some pointers and some tips on crafting a book. Vito.
And we have the premier book writer listening in to everything we're saying here, Dennis Griffith, who's written 11 crime books. He's one of our people here on Crime Wire, so he really knows how to put these things together. But you know, it's definitely a whodunit now, and hopefully by the time you do write that book, it's solved because you're a private detective, you got a PI, a former officer on the police department. This is your father's case, so it's not like just one that you got accustomed to in your county that piqued your interest. So you got a lot of interesting things there of that nature, you know. So I wish you the best with all of that, and we're here to help you. Please keep in touch with us. Call us. Let us know when the arrests are made, and that would be a good day, you know.
Well, I would appreciate that.
Are you getting any support from the media? Has any local reporters from Arizona or from Riverside, California, been made aware of what you're doing?
Well, right now the only thing I've been able to do is get local media. I did an interview with KVOA, they're a local station there in Tucson, in February, and I did an interview with Lupita Murillo, and that was really that was good and a good thing to do. I'm also working with a producer at 48 Hours. They're looking very closely at the story. It looks like they're probably going to take the story. We're just putting some things together right now. So wherever I can, I'm having some billboards put up in the next couple of weeks in Tucson about the story. So I'm doing whatever I can to keep it out there, which, as you well know, is so very important.
How about reward money? Does that ever come in?
I'm working with 88 Crime, and they offer a $1,000 reward for any information that will be on the billboard. Additional reward money, I'm in California, and if I was in Arizona, it would be different. I could do all kinds of things to raise money for reward. So it's limiting being here in California. It's a little frustrating for me.
Yeah. Vito, any thoughts on that?
Let me know how the 48-hour thing goes. I do have several good connections there. Lisa Fried, I don't know if you're dealing with her, who's one of their top producers there. I've done many shows for her. So let me know if there's any assistance on that, that you need. Tell them you did our show, Crime Wire, and you've done many, many things to keep this going, you know. But that's the show to be on, because they do a great job on their cases. You know, Erin Moriarty, who's won numerous Emmys, she did the last episode I did there, murder of Kissel, Andrew Kissel, in Connecticut. So she's great to deal with, too. But, you know, any help we can give you or I can give you, please call me, okay?
Oh, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Well, listen. We will be in touch. Keep us updated on the progress of the investigation, and we look forward to hearing from you.
All right. Thank you so much, gentlemen. I appreciate the time.
Oh, thank
you. You're quite
welcome.
Thank you for coming and sharing your story. All right, Vito, I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, interesting case, huh, Tom?
Hope
for the best with this one, you know what I mean? But anyway, going to our second case tonight, the mysterious death of 11-year-old Selena Cass of New Hampshire. Just last month, Selena Cass, an 11-year-old girl living in northern New Hampshire near the Canadian border, went missing. Selena was last seen alive about 9 p.m. on Monday, July the 25th. The girl had been last seen sitting at a computer in the home she lived with her mother, her stepfather, and her 13-year-old sister. The following day, police launched an intense search that involved 100 local, state, and federal law enforcement authorities. The search ended abruptly on Monday, August 1st, when police divers discovered Selena's body in a river close to a hydroelectric dam just a quarter of a mile from her home. The police said the death appeared suspicious. An autopsy was performed. However, the medical examiner was unable to determine the manner and cause of death. Authorities are waiting for the results of toxicology examinations. The investigation continues. Police have executed search warrants at the girl's home and have towed away two vehicles, including one registered to her stepfather. The stepfather has a history of mental illness and checked himself into a medical facility after Selena's body was recovered. Police have not named anyone as a person of interest. How does an 11-year-old end up in a river under suspicious circumstances, and who might have immersed her in the water? Why has the manner and cause of death not been determined? These are among the many lingering questions about this mystery. Tom, interesting case.
It is, I made some comments locally here last week. When I heard that the body had been discovered and that it was in a body of water and the police deemed it to be suspicious. My immediate suspicion was that the body was either encased or wrapped in something and weighted down. Word I'm getting now through back channels is that the child's body was wrapped in a blanket. And, you know, I know that the, you know, that immersion of water for an extended period of time is going to, you know, perhaps interfere with the, you know, the forensics on that. And, you know, joining us here this evening is, you know, the, well, the voice of authority, and that would be Dean Beers and Karen Beers, forensic experts. They're here with us on the line right now to share their perspective on, you know, how, you know, what are the problems associated with the body in water. Dean and Karen, good evening.
Hello, Tom.
Good evening, Tom. Good evening.
All right. So you've heard some background on this, but why don't you hang on for just 1 second. Vito,
yes.
your thoughts on the issue here, the father, the vehicle being taken away. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, also the listeners need to understand there was another individual also living in that house for approximately a year by the name of Kevin Mullaney. Now, he moved in with the family about a year before this took place. Now, his relationship to this family is that Louisa Noyles, who is, now this gets a little tricky, so everybody pay attention, Selena's mom used to have a boyfriend that was this Mulaney's father, okay? So this Mulaney is the son of Selena's mom's former boyfriend. Okay, if everybody got that. So I guess it's one of those situations that even though she was broken up with her boyfriend, maybe trying to help this guy out or something, he has a criminal history as well as the stepfather. So you have a lot of interesting things going on here, Tom. You got individuals in this house. This Mulaney, if I read right, he had been arrested. He stole 5 cars and trucks. In 2007, he was sentenced to one and a half, three years in prison. And, you know, so you got two individuals that both have done some prison time here, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, normally, you know, who do we look at when, you know, an 11-year-old goes missing? And certainly, before, you know, I ask you to answer that, it's rare for an 11-year-old to commit suicide. And so that's off the table. And again, you know, Dean and Karen will be able to tell us about the 4 manners of death, natural causes, accidental, suicide, or homicide. I don't know. Let's bring Karen and Dean in here. The body being in the water for four or five days, or even a little longer, what kind of an impact does that have on making the determination and the cause of death?
Well, the water can play different roles, and it just depends on the temperature of the water, whether the body was protected in any way. I can remember a case that I assisted on with the autopsy. The lady was submerged in water for 8 months, and the thing about this one was they knew that she had an accident, so they knew her body was in that water, you know, so they'd been looking for it. So this was an accident, but what was interesting was that part of her body was underneath a rock, a boulder, and so the parts that were exposed was all skeletonized, but the rest was very preserved. It was amazing to see this, but it's still, when it comes to getting the toxicology, if the organs are all there, they can get different tox. But as far as like some of the things are going to be pretty hard to tell at this point, you know. Plus, they don't really want to say too much.
Would they be able to determine if the child was alive when she went into the water? And how would they?
Well, if the lungs, at the, you know, depending again if the temperature and how decomposed the body is when it was retrieved from the water, they should be able to tell, depending, you know, if the lungs, if they get the lungs, and they should be able to tell that.
Yeah, and also Dino, with
have you
had any
cases?
And stuff.
Dean,
pardon me, Dean.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, there also might be sediment and stuff from the water, the dirt, or even if she ingested something or was forced to ingest something. You know, if the esophagus and stuff and trachea are intact, you know, there could be some indications in there, which is what leads to determining if there was drowning. And, of course, if she were killed before that, whether it be by toxicology or, you know, a violent act or, you know, including suffocation, there might be some indications, you know, that would be very helpful on that. Karen's example was very good. I was also at that autopsy just observing and stuff, but there were some well-preserved. If it would have been a homicide, for example, or suspicious death, there was definitely some evidence that would have been well-preserved just because of the position she was in. And being wrapped in that blanket at this point might also help preserve some evidence. So hopefully there's something good that comes out of that.
Let me ask you this. Vito mentioned earlier that the cops are waiting for results of toxicology examination. Give us some examples. What would they be looking for with this 11-year-old girl?
Well,
one
they could
example
be looking
be,
for drugs.
Drugs?
Yeah.
Alcohol?
Yep.
It wouldn't be unusual for an 11-year-old to be given alcohol, unfortunately. You know, the chloroform to go back to another more infamous event. Anything that would make
a
person incapacitated. Yeah.
Rufinol?
Exactly. Yes, that would be, yeah, get some roofies would definitely date rape drugs, MDMA. You know, things like that might be something to look to. Anything that would incapacitate her in some way. Unfortunately, some of those will dissipate over a period of time, regardless of how the body's kept. But given that it was only a week, the chances are pretty good that they'll still be able to get something, you know, to look for those drugs and even elements. And even you know, skin, there might be indications of injuries and stuff that they haven't disclosed that would have been preserved with the condition of the body.
Hey, Vito, do you think any polygraph work would be in order here?
That's always one of the first things that I try to do. And even if they say no, I always like to see the reaction to the people as they sit across the table to me, from me when I say, would you be willing to take a polygraph so we can eliminate you here or move on with our case. So I'm always interested in that. But, you know, one thing I wanted to say, Tom, here too, and because, you know, we deal with a lot of cold cases, and I want to give some kudos, though, to the police for the intensive search that they did. I mean, she was alive on July 25th. That's very recently. And they had 100 local, state, and federal law enforcement authorities working on this. And they found her body, which, as you and Dean and Karen know, quite early in the investigation, okay, even though she was in the water those several days. So that does help the case, you know, tremendously. I want to know where the blanket comes from. I want to do some investigative work on the blanket and see where that came from. I want to check, I want to see the undercarriage of the vehicles to see any kind of dirt, any kind of specific dirt. You know yourself, Tom, and I'm sure Dean and his wife knows that as you're in different areas of town and different areas. I remember when the Natalie Peterson case was on, I spoke extensively on TV about how on Aruba you could be at one part and another part would be different dirt, different sand, the whole bit. So I'm sure, well, I'm hoping they're doing the undercarriage of the car, the tires, just to see whatever pops up on these things, you know. So it's an all-encompassing job, and it's still a pretty new case.
So what you're saying is they want to make a determination of where a vehicle may have been parked along that river and then the child's body thrown into the water. Is that
right,
essentially
if they,
what you're saying?
If they can come up with one nugget of something, you see, it's definitely a worthwhile thing to do that, the undercarriage, the tires. Hopefully when they did the search warrants, they got some work boots or sneakers of the individuals where they can check underneath those shoes and see if it matches up to the area maybe near where she was thrown in the water or any place around that general area. So, you know, it's an all-encompassing, tedious job, but you got to do that. You have to do that.
Dean, at the scene along the water, what would they be looking for that would be transferred from the truck to the scene beyond, tire impressions? What else might be left there that they could match up to one of those vehicles?
Yeah, there could be, and also on the body within the blanket, could be evidence of brush, evidence of hair and fibers from another person, evidence of recent damage or scratches to the truck, maybe driving through a wooded area. There's been recent cases of concrete dust from a construction site where they actually committed the act and then transported the body elsewhere, and they were able to make that connection because of the formula in the concrete and stuff. So those are different things it would look for. And I did have a question. Do we know if she was clothed within the blanket or not?
They have been tight-lipped about the terminal circumstances, other than to say that the body was in the water. I learned from some of my sources that it was a blanket, and now that's being reported in the media, but they haven't gone beyond that. Again, when they said the body was, it appeared to be a suspicious death, that led me to believe that this was not a suicide. Again, that's a rare statistical phenomenon for an 11-year-old. And
suicide is very rare.
Yeah, I just didn't buy that. And again, the child did look a little older, and but again, if we can to talk about the actions of the stepfather, he had a history of mental illness, and the day that this child's remains were recovered, he was acting out there at the home, laying on the ground, rolling over, and had to be taken to the hospital for examination. Vito, your thoughts on
another
that?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be very important, Tom. I hate to say it, and through my lifetime, because of the mental illness of a immediate family member of mine, unfortunately, I became a expert in that, okay, which has helped me in my career. That could be a very big thing for the police, because he's in the hospital. The doctor's going to be talking to him. They're going to bring up many, many different things to him, and the police are waiting anxiously to get any kind of sentence or anything that he does say, and to watch his manner there to see. Because, you know, don't forget, this is a guy here, this Wendell Knowles. 2003, he broke into his ex-girlfriend's home and threatened to throw her down a flight of stairs, and he was committed to a psychiatric hospital after that incident in 2003. So, you know, he suffered with this for many, many years. And it's interesting to watch, because I think he will be the key. But let me say one more quick thing, and it just struck me before when Dean was following up on my stuff that I was talking about, the tires and the undercarriage. The importance of solving this case early is that right now there's a lot of people working on this case, which brings fresh ideas. You see what we're doing tonight? There's only a handful of us. But I named some stuff, and then Dean brought up totally different things from me. And, Tom, you would bring up totally different things, too. So what I mean is we're all using our expertise and our background with ideas. I'm saying undercarriage and tire. Dean brings up the other stuff. So when you have a lot of people working a case, you're able to solve it a lot better, because just what we did tonight, all these different ideas and theories. Now, what happens to a case, as everybody in this panel knows, and our listeners need to understand, as a couple months go by, the vast majority of those people working it are going to go back to other assignments. Where you had 10 people working it, it's cut to 5, it's cut to 2, and as more time goes on, you have one investigator that's just fielding calls and leads. So it's very important that a lot of stuff gets done rather quickly on this.
Regarding the stepfather's mental illness, would he be an appropriate candidate for a polygraph, and what are the implications of that?
Is that for me, Tom, or?
Yeah. I mean, you know, is this appropriate to give somebody that's got, you know, a mental affliction?
That's a great question, because somebody that's psychotic, or you know, this family member of mine actually thought, as she was walking down the street, certain individuals by name were on the other side yelling and following her. So if she believed that in her head, I'm sure if they hooked her up to a polygraph, it would probably come out that she's telling the truth. You follow what I'm saying? Because
yeah,
that's what happens with mentally ill people. I maybe still want to do it just for the heck of it, to see what does come up on it. You know, I mean, you know, and just to see, will it be useful? I don't know. But that's a great question. I never even thought about that ever or heard of it. So,
yeah. Now let me throw this out there. What impact has the Casey Anthony verdict had on cases? And about this case, it seems to me that the cops are really going slowly here and methodically. Any thoughts, anybody?
Yeah, they've definitely, from what I've seen, gone a little bit slower, more methodical. But then again, with the Casey Anthony case, you know, from what and Karen can say more than I can on that, you know, it definitely seemed like they had a methodical case, just had an over expectation of the jury, and just in my opinion, I mean, I think the evidence was presented well. I don't think it was over presented. I don't think it was above, you know, anybody's head. But I think in this case, they're going to, you know, look extra carefully and document extra carefully, you know, anything and everything that they can.
Well, let's assume that there was an arrest, and you know, of somebody, and they don't have a man or cause right now. If I were the lawyer, or if I were the PI working for the attorney, I suppose I would be looking for you know reasonable doubt. Now, the question is, what happened? Did the child have a history of drinking alcohol? Did the child accidentally die, and then was the child disposed of? So now you don't have a murder. What you really have here is a disposable of a dead body.
One example that comes to mind is when I was asking, for example, if she was clothed, would be not only evidence on the clothing, but the condition of the clothing, torn, taken off, looks like she was redressed, if she was in the same clothes she was, you know, last seen, and that type of thing. But, you know, if she had and I don't know if she has any kind of medical conditions that could, you know, attribute to her death in some way. For example, if she were given a drug and had a reaction, or maybe if she were even being raped and had a medical condition kick in and cause her death. Not that that would excuse anything, it would still be attributory, but it would be something that would cast a reasonable shadow on some of the charging that would take place in the course of the defense of that.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I mean, that's just, you know, my, you know, quick perspective on, I would think that they would have descended and made an arrest, you know, pretty quickly. But, I'm just wondering, in light of the Casey Anthony case, are the cops being a little more cautious and, you know, really want to make sure they have it solid before they do anything?
Let me throw this out to you, Tom, because you brought up an interesting point. Casey Anthony case, her body is found months and months later. Where? Right around the corner from the family home where Casey Anthony played and where Casey Anthony a lot of times just was in those woods. Okay. Now, obviously, the cops have said, well, you know, there was storms and it was a flooded area. So when we went there, we really couldn't go in there. That doesn't hold water with me, pardon the pun, because I stated boldly on the show that if I was working that case, I would have found her body a lot sooner around the corner from their house. Now, look at the difference. Fast forward to this case. Where do they find her? They go to a hydroelectric dam. Okay, only a quarter of a mile from her home, and in the water they find her body. Now, what does that do? The body's found a lot quicker than Casey Anthony's body, where there was nothing left of her. Okay, so there's the big difference in police work. And this is not to knock the Florida one, but they did make some mistakes in that one. That body should have been found well before the time that they did. And this is kudos to this police department for what they did on this case. I'm telling you, that's a difference.
Sure, they had not only New Hampshire Fish and Game, New Hampshire State Police, local police. They had FBI. They had the Royal Canadian Mounted Police assisting, as well as state troopers from Massachusetts who were up there with dogs and vehicles out there in the woods searching. And I got to believe that early on when they began speaking to the family members, that their BS meters started registering when there were inconsistencies in statements, and I think they felt right off the bat that this was not a runaway, and that this was probably not a kid that had a history of depression, and in all likelihood the child was a victim of a homicide, and that's how they treated it. They went out there, and when they're in the water, and when they called in for more troops, and they had 100 boots on the ground or 200 boots on the ground, they were looking to recover something.
Yeah, and not only that, whether it's Dean or Karen or you and me being the first on the scene to this house and talking to them and seeing the cast of characters, so to speak, you know, and their criminal histories and their actions and their movements, and there's probably even the theme from Deliverance playing in the background, which would be a dead giveaway. But, you know, it's another whole story. But, you know, you use your intuition. You know, I've always said the most important tool, I learned this on the police department, the most important tool a private detective or a police officer has is common sense. What to do, how to act, and how to respond in every given situation. You can have all the master's degrees and everything else, which are very, very good, okay? But you got to have that common sense to look at a situation and say, man, I don't like that guy over there. There's something about him. I got a funny feeling about him. And the other guy goes into the mental institution. As soon as the body's found, there's something going on here. And you guys all know that. That's what you do. You never have a tunnel vision where you just think about that one person, but you definitely have them in your mind, at least, as a suspect.
Hey, Vito, let me hold you right there. You used the words tunnel vision. One of our guests here, Dean Beers, recently wrote an article in PI Magazine, our number one trade journal, and wasn't it entitled Tunnel Vision?
Actually, it was Tunnel Intelligence. And
tunnel
it's
intelligence.
The same concept, yeah, except for it's basically, any investigator, whether it be law enforcement, reporter, insurance adjuster, private investigator, limiting themselves to the knowledge that they have either in conducting the investigation or even the evidentiary knowledge, instead of going out, you know, outside of that, asking for help. You know, like Vito mentioned earlier, there's, you know, three, four, five of us here just talking about this with three, four, five different ideas. If I don't reach out to that, I'm limiting my intelligence.
There you are, yeah, being short-sighted.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is right now a case that's going to rely on the forensic determination here. Is that correct? Would you say, you know, all three of you?
Yeah, I would definitely agree.
Yeah, it's definitely going to add a substantial piece once that does come out. That, you know, that's for sure.
Well, the thing is, they still may not. It just depends on the condition of her body. They may not be able to determine the cause, but obviously, just like little Kaylee, she didn't wrap herself in a blanket and trash bags and throw herself. And this child, I'm sure, didn't wrap herself in a blanket and throw herself in the water. The thing is, the bottom line is, you have somebody else doing this to a child in both cases. And if they don't find the cause of death, in this case as well, you know, this concept that these jurors are supposed to know the cause of death, I don't know when this came into play, other than the CSI effect. But,
yeah,
you know, if you have the information, you have a body, and hopefully, you know, this one has been found soon enough that they can determine at least the cause of death. But it could be that they can't.
But even if they made an arrest here, the defense could assert a theory that, again, like the Kaylee Anthony death, that it was
right.
an accident and that the body
yep.
was merely disposed.
Exactly. And then what? Is this okay? You know, is this what we do? You know, is this going to make it okay to do this? I don't know. Or you and you already have this. This man is schizophrenic, or that's what they have stated. So if he is involved, well, his mental illness is going to play a big role. Just like, you know, Casey's, she's ill. She's mentally ill. But I'd be a little concerned about this 23-year-old. You know.
Yeah, definitely.
In the house.
And one thing to keep in mind that we haven't talked about is you know, injuries to the body, specifically sex assault. And, you know, if the body's wrapped in a blanket and if it's, you know, actually preserved, like Karen's example was, the motorcycle rider, you know, you may be able to collect forensic evidence, you know, from the purposes of different sex acts, as well as seeing, you know, actual physical trauma that may have taken place, which, of course, eliminates, you know, well, at least in our minds, I think I can speak, you know, an accident, you know, and then disposing of the body. If there's lack of injuries, then there's other issues that I think it sounds like this police department is working really diligently to uncover.
But the body's decomposition in that water is really going to have an adverse effect on the forensic determination. Is that correct?
It can.
Yes,
but
it can.
Remembering that water, you know, is still, you know, fairly cold even in the summertime, and especially up in New Hampshire, and that helps us a little bit, and the body was found fast. So I'm just kind of hoping that with it being wrapped in a blanket and possibly in some brush or behind boulders or somehow protected a little bit, that there's a reasonable chance that we have, you know, at least some components intact. It's not unlike a desert body, which is a hugely problematic issue. But we just have to wait and see.
Have they stated how deep of water she was in, or, you know, if she was just found, you know, close to the bank or along the bank, or did they say?
Yeah, she was at the base of the dam.
So she was submerged in the water.
No, well, I would say that it's at least 12, 15 feet from what I saw visually. You know, the divers were there. They were tethered. Again, it's a dam that, you know, it's a hydroelectric dam. So, you know, I'm sure that there's a great deal of force of water running over.
Right.
You know, but, I mean, I think it's something that, you know, we would enjoy having Dean and Karen return once this case is closed, or if there's more activity on it, to you know, come back and give us your forensic perspective on what has gone on.
Yeah, I think it's going to be solved sooner rather than later. I just got a good feeling about this, and I hope I'm right.
Yeah.
The only thing, like Karen says, if it winds up being a stepfather, it's not like he's pretending now that all of a sudden he's mentally ill, like a lot of people do on cases. He's got a history, or at least from 2003, where he's in and out of hospital. So that would be the difficult part with that.
Right.
No. They're never clear cut.
No.
No. Another sad case, you know.
It is. And one final note on another subject. Apparently, another young woman from America has gone missing down in Aruba.
Yeah, I just saw it today on Fox News.
I missed that one.
Yeah, just breaking news, and well, maybe we'll be talking about that, you know, in a couple of weeks.
They do have a potential suspect in custody, from what I understand.
Well, all right. We'll see what happens. Karen, Dean, thank you so much for participating tonight. You always bring a wealth of information to share with our listeners.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. All right,
okay.
Vito.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you,
right.
Karen.
Dean. Bye, Vito.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks to the CrimeWire team, especially our director of research, Double K, Kimmy Colton, public relations team at Imagine Publicity. Our next show will be Tuesday, August the 16th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com, turn on the volume of your computer, and the show will automatically play.
Okay, remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Tom Shanshak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Till we see you again next week, talk to you again, thank you, and good night.
Good night, Vito.
Good night, Tom.
Bye-bye.